Our choices here are broken. As children grow with what they see. And in these times where paranoia closes in, power and hate are rampaging disease. In our minds we build the blocks to what we need. In our minds we're reaching out for peace. In our hearts we know of such the hills to climb. In our hearts a sense of master feed.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stephen Hill, who's a writer, columnist, and political professional. He's the former director of the Political Reform Program at the New America Foundation, and his books include 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics, and Whose Vote Counts. His latest book is Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope for an Insecure Age. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Hill.
Thank you, Ian. My pleasure.
And Europe, of course, or the European Union, has just received the Nobel Peace Prize. I suppose you could make a joke and say, well, at least they didn't receive the Nobel Economics Prize. To tell me, what is it about this Peace Prize that Europe has gotten, particularly in the context of what has been a two-year-long agony in terms of the euro crisis?
Well, like you say, this is not an economics prize. This is a peace prize. And if you look at it from that point of view, and you think about the history of the world in the last 100 years, where and the centuries before that, where Europe fought war after war after war, France against the UK, against Germany, against Spain. I mean, you know, this is a place that has fought the bloodiest of wars. And compared to those times, Europe is a remarkably peaceful place. So you have to look at it from that perspective. I mean, you know, the Nobel Committee does have a history of surprising recipients, including Henry Kissinger, Barack Obama, who had barely been in office a couple of months. And sometimes they seem to give the prize based on their hopes and their aspirations, not necessarily on achievements. But in this case, I think it's totally well-founded. The Union has certainly done a huge amount to spread peace, not only on the European continent, but in its near abroad, Turkey. I mean, you know, Turkey used to be a place routinely condemned by Amnesty International as a military dictatorship. Today it's a secular Islamic democracy, and much of that is because of the incentives that Europe offered to Turkey to join the European Union at some point. So I think there's many, many ways you can look at this and realize that this is a fitting and proper use of the Nobel Peace Prize.
So I guess this is a case of giving an award to the European Union for the fact that they've been at peace for decades, as opposed to giving it to somebody that's trying to stop wars today in the war-torn part of the world. You just mentioned the Middle East. Now, it's true that maybe in several decades from now, who knows? I mean, in many ways, I just was speaking to somebody yesterday who said, an Egyptian-born New York Times veteran reporter, who said that he was surprised in terms of the downturn in Egypt and in terms of its Arab Spring democratic potential. With this reversal by Morsi and the power grab and the street demonstrations, he said the one thing that gave him hope was that there are a lot of liberals and secularists out there fighting against this Islamic takeover. So what about the idea, though, of giving it to somebody from these parts of the world that are fighting the good fight now, not celebrating, the last of the wars that ended in 1945?
Well, I don't know what the philosophy is of the Nobel Committee when they pick these things. I mean, certainly they give one every year, so maybe that will be the recipient this year. I mean, sometimes they give it to noted individuals for and not someone who we've heard of for the sometimes grassroots work they've been doing. Other times they give it to, you know, world-famous figures. And they don't often give it to organizations. But I think, particularly when you think about the challenges that the world is facing today, including the economic challenges, but also the ecological challenges, global climate change. I mean, no place on planet Earth has done more to try and rein in their carbon emissions and to create an economy that's sustainable than Europe has. And so, and as I mentioned earlier, the political union that they've got and how it's put to rest centuries of war is again a model for other places around the world. Their current economic challenges are, that's a longer conversation, but it's really not a product of that the European economies aren't working as much as that Europe is in the process of deciding, do they want to become, in the next stage of their evolution, a United States of Europe? Do they want to pool their budgets, and do they want to pool their banks and their tax revenues in the way that we do here in the United States of America? That's a huge decision that's going to take many years, not only to make that decision, but then to put the institutions in place that facilitate that decision. And so you have to separate out the current economic challenges that Europe is going through with the political victories they've already won, their leadership they're showing on ecological issues, sustainability issues, and these sorts of things. And you know, there is no perfect in this world. Every place has its challenges. No place is doing it 100% right. But when you look at all the other regions of the world, including here in the United States, even today, Europe is doing many, many things right. And places like Sweden, Germany, many of the member states in the European Union are, in fact, they're the progressive dream. I mean, everything that progressives want, universal health care, better policies for retirement, all these sorts of things, they already have that. And that's what we're fighting for here in the United States. So there's much you can point to at Europe, despite the headlines that we're seeing out day after day, that many of them, I think, are somewhat propagandistic. That, there are many conservatives in this country that don't want Americans to look at Europe as a model. So they have a vested interest in just keeping the problems that Europe's having right now constantly in the headlines.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Hill, who is a writer, columnist, and political professional. He's the former director of the Political Reform Program at the New America Foundation, and his latest book is Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope for an Insecure World. And there's no question the difference between the standard of living in these European social democracies and the United States is stark. And everything that we can only dream of here in the United States is taken for granted, like full health care coverage, pregnancy leaves, 6 weeks vacation. You mentioned how Europe has taken the lead in carbon reductions to the only along with Australia, the only people that came out of the Doha round of the Kyoto Protocols, which are extended in 2020, and only Europe and Australia are sticking to the greenhouse gas reduction targets. So there's many things, and it's true, I think, that we are propagandized here in the United States to believe that not only is Europe dying under socialism, but so is our Canadians to the north of us here are suffering under free health care, etc. It is monstrous and venal propaganda when you consider what these countries provide for their citizens in spite of their shaky economy at the moment, compared to what's happening in this country, where what little we have in terms of a social safety net is under attack from the Republicans and from the deficit hawks. So,
I just wrote an article that's supposed to come out at theatlantic.com sometime this week about how we here in the United States could double the Social Security payout. And we could do that really simply by, making everybody pay the same amount, the same percentage, because right now people who make above $108,000 don't pay any more into the Social Security fund. And then a lot of businesses that provide pensions for their employees, they get to get a big whopping deduction from the federal government for providing that pension, even though the employees are paying into that to get the pension as well. But if we double the Social Security payout, that businesses don't need to provide pensions anymore. So just by making those two changes, we would raise about two-thirds of the revenue needed to double the Social Security payout. And, other places in Europe are already doing this. And so, when we read about that somehow Europe is falling apart. It's having some challenges, and certain member states like Greece, certainly Spain and others more than the other ones. And they're in the process, and it's going to take years to figuring out of how to, you know, to perfect a union to a United States of Europe. But you can't compare that to what we have here in the United States, where we have so much wealth, and yet it is not distributed fairly. It is not distributed broadly. We are, the average American is pumping twice as much carbon into the environment as the average European. And our cars use far more fuel than the Europeans or Japanese or anyone. So, you know, President Obama isn't doing nearly enough in so many ways to push the Congress to enact the policies that we need in this country, in my view. So, you know, going back to the original subject, Nobel Peace Prize for Europe. Sure, I think it's fitting. Europe is providing a model for the world. Europe is not perfect. It has its challenges, but no place is. And I think we have a lot to learn from them.
And Stephen Hill, in terms of your book, Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope for an Insecure Age, has Europe's economic problems essentially made it impossible for the debate to take place in this country in order to make the American people recognize how much worse off they are than the average European in terms of the quality of their life, in terms of the government services? I mean, it seems to me at the heart of the problem here in the United States compared to the Europeans is that Europeans vote for politicians who deliver social services. They have a pretty simple formula. We pay our taxes and we expect government services in return. And they get extraordinarily good government services, but they do pay more taxes. Here we pay, we are taxed among the lowest in the world. But we also have the worst government services and the least government services. But we have an enormous amount of right-wing welfare, like the defense budget, agribusiness, etc. And it seems to me that this simple notion, this practical notion of you vote for people who deliver services, is not in our political DNA. We vote for people based upon things like abortion, for God's sake, that have nothing to do with politics.
Well, 2 points. First, it's somewhat of a myth that that Europeans pay more in taxes than we do here in the United States, because if you look at, for example, Americans, we're paying twice as much money per capita for health care. We're paying a lot more out of pocket to get things like daycare. University students are paying far more money for university education, for tuition, than they are in Europe. And I can list a whole host of things in which Americans are paying far more out of pocket to get the same services that Europeans are getting in exchange for their taxes. And so if you just look at it through the narrow lens of taxes, then yeah, it looks like Europeans pay more. But really, what difference does it make which pocket it comes out of? Does it come out of taxes or come out of your out-of-pocket expenses, your discretionary income? Either way, you're paying. And when you add up the whole ball of wax up and, you know, both sides of the ledger, what you're paying for what you get, you discover that Americans are paying far, at least as much as Europeans are, but we're getting far less for our money. And that comes down to your other point, which is the politics. And that's really where, if you don't have politics that rein in your economics, you're really going to be in trouble. And that's what we have in the United States, a problem where, you know, we've had a long-standing political collapse before we had the economic collapse. That's why the average American's wages haven't gone up for a couple of decades. And there are real reasons for that. It's because we don't have things like public financing of campaigns, free media time for candidates. We don't have proportional representation, which creates multi-party democracy, which gives voters more choice, so you're not taken for granted by the Democrats or Republicans, because now voters have other choices out there. We don't have universal automatic voter registration. Instead, we have about 25% to 30% of Americans who are eligible to vote but aren't even registered to vote. The voter turnout we just had in the presidential election was lower in this year than it was in 2004 when John Kerry ran against George W. Bush. You know, we don't have a good robust public broadcasting sector. I mean, if it wasn't for KPFK and other Pacifica stations, we would really have hardly any inquiring media at all in the United States. But in Europe, they have, you know, public broadcasting gets $40, $50 per capita. Here in the United States, public broadcasting gets $3 per capita. You know, they have public finance of campaigns. They have free media time. They have universal voter registration. In short, they have a more robust democracy that not only creates multi-party representation in the legislatures, and which, but that also produces more debate of issues. I mean, if you think about how the American political system works, you know, if I'm the head of the Democratic Party, I can look out there in the political landscape and I can say, okay, these districts over here, we know we're going to win those. We don't have to worry about those. These ones over here, we're never going to win. So we just focus in on about three dozen races out of 435 seats in the House of Representatives that are going to decide the majority. And so what should be a national election becomes this sliced and diced electorate of swing voters in swing states and swing congressional districts that decide our elections. And so, you know, when you do that, you lose the national discussion about what are the issues of the times. And so in so many ways, our political system is just really, really holding us back from having a full discussion of what the issues are, what the solutions might be. Whereas in Europe, they have this kind of full, robust discussion of all these issues, and that has led to better policy on things like health care, retirement, child care, parental leave, vacation, for, you know, all the studies show that a well-rested workforce is a more productive workforce. And that's how Europe has been able to maintain its wealth for so many years, is because their workers are so productive. And right. Part of that is how they're treated. They're treated better. I mean, Germany has pioneered things like co-determination, where the workers get to elect 50% of the members of the boards of directors of major corporations, Fortune 500 companies. You know, it'd be like if Walmart in the United States had to, by law, allow its workers to elect 50% of the members of its board of directors. That's what they have all across Europe. So in just so many ways, Europe is really modern society 2.0. Their politics, their economics, you know, at the member state level, not at the European-wide level, where they're still trying to figure out whether to become the United States of Europe or not. At the environmental level, all these ways, Europe is just really setting the standards that the rest of the world should be learning from.
Well, Stephen Hill, I thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my great pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Hill, who is a writer, columnist, and political professional. He's a former director of political reform program at the New America Foundation. His books include 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics, and Whose Vote Counts. His latest book is Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope for an Insecure Age. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and I'll answer your questions. The conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.